Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
This is John Paul.
And this is another X Tuesday episode. We're continuing our look at House of X, Powers of 10. We're up to Powers of 10, number two, after the big reveal in House of X, number two, about Moira McTaggart being a mutant. So a lot to unpack here. And this one, it's interesting. We start to see some of the actual real world applications of knowing that Moira, you know, reincarnates over time. And I have questions, Jonathan Hickman. I have a lot of questions. Hearing John Paul talk about sort of how a lot of the answers to these questions, especially in Powers of 10, haven't been answered even now. And social media, a lot of you guys are telling me the same thing. We're still waiting to basically see the payoff for some of the things that Hickman has planted the seeds for in this Powers of 10 issue. So I don't know, you think we'll ever see it, John Paul, or do you think, I mean, Hickman, he just plants so many seeds and maybe he gets to it, maybe not. What do you think?
Of all the things that I think that he's going to get to, this one might be the one that he might not, you know, just because it seems so far in the future. He might not get to that. Marvel might not allow him to, you know?
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, when we get to, especially the text at the end that talks about the different sort of societies, you know, I mean, these are giant concepts that I think a lot of comic fans, they don't want to think that hard. You know what I mean? I'm not saying anybody's dumb or unintelligent. I'm just saying, they just want to pick up a comic and read it and escape. You know, they don't want to have to do research on the internet to understand these hive mind concepts and things like that. And actually reminds me of something that I was talking with Mike Avila about. We were just, John Paul and I were just talking about it. My interview with him, it'll come out the same day you're hearing this episode. And he's a big comic fan. He's been a television producer for a long time, worked in kind of the entertainment part of it, doing interviews with celebrities and such in New York for a long time. And, you know, now with Sci-Fi Wire, and you know, he was talking about how much he loves the X-Men and how C.B. Sobolski was telling him San Diego Comic-Con 2019, before this stuff had kind of hit. Yeah, it's great jumping on point. You know, if you've never read X-Men, man, that's not true. Like, you can't just pick up House of X, Powers of X. I mean, you can, but there is just knowledge that you don't have, and you can dive in the way that I dove in when I was a kid and just read and figured I'll pick it up as I go along. Now there's the internet, you can do research again, but that's kind of like homework. But you know, there's something to be said for the fact that you can't just pick these up and read them. They're not, you know, for kids or that kind of thing, the way comics were back in the day. This isn't, you know, the X-Men cartoon or the X-Men Adventures comic that was based on the cartoon where the ideas are kind of simple. And it's good versus evil. These are more interesting concepts, which is great. But again, it does have that barrier to entry. And then when you're talking about Hickman, you're raising that up even more just because the guy has all these crazy complicated ideas. So yeah, it's, I don't know. Would you, as an X-Men fan, John Paul, if somebody came to you and said, hey, I want to learn about the X-Men. I've watched the X-Men movies. I love them. Where do I start? Would you point them to House of X, Powers of X?
No, not necessarily. I kind of think you should start with the Chris Claremont stuff. Because that's where a lot of the foundation is laid. Mm-hmm. But like, if I were to give them a skipping point, I'd say after Chris Claremont, there's not a whole lot. Just skip right to House of X, Powers of 10. Like,
yeah, but if you're gonna read the Claremont stuff, I mean, you're talking about from the early 80s all the way, you know, that's like a 12 or 14 year run.
Right.
That's a lot of stuff. So yeah, you're right. You're going to have a foundation. And that's exactly what I would say. You and I are on the same page there. I would point, I don't know if Marvel still makes the Essential line where there were the black and white reprints. But either way, you could tell them, hey, go get Marvel Unlimited. That's really the best value.
Yes.
And just start with Claremont, you know, with the new X-Men, when Colossus and Storm and Nightcrawler and Sunfire and everybody came on the team, and just start reading, man. That's a good starting point. I agree 100%. Cause you're going to be introduced to you know, a lot of these characters. You're going to get Magneto. You're going to get, you know, obviously Wolverine's a big part of that. Alpha Flight, you know, Cable eventually, Strife, you know, all Mr. Sinister, all that stuff is all Claremont. So yeah, here is not where I would, tell somebody to start. So, all right, let's go ahead and dive into the issue. Powers of 10, number 2 of 6. Pretty cool cover. We've got Sabretooth. We've got Magneto in that white costume. Mystique, the White Queen, who we haven't seen before. And then I'm not even sure, I guess that's Toad's new look, looking a little more svelte than he has looked in the past. So we turn to the first page, again, text page, which Hickman is famous for, which we'll talk a little bit about. I had some interaction with some people online this week about text pages, so we'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. But it's a quote from Magneto on the first page saying, "There is a chasm between you and I, Charles, a gap that cannot be crossed. With each passing day, I fear it never will be." And this is really, in my mind, Hickman telling us and illustrating, reminding us about that gap between Magneto and Xavier. And the era of X-Men that we're just talking about really stresses that. Those early Magneto appearances in Claremont's run, where Magneto is, you know, that's where he sunk the submarine, the Russian submarine, when they attacked him, which was something that was held over his head for a really long time, and why all the other heroes of the Marvel Universe saw him as a villain. It's why he eventually stood trial. It was things like that that really kind of showed the stark contrast between Xavier and his wanting to exist peacefully alongside Homo sapiens, and Magneto, who said, "Hey, whatever we got to do to show that we're the superior race so that they'll leave us alone." So that's kind of what that quote is all about. And when we turn the page, it's X to the Zero Power, X-Men Year One, and we're on Island M, which is, again, around that same period, Magneto's kind of home base. And when this got destroyed, he moved up to Asteroid M. But it's in the Bermuda Triangle, and we see Moira McTaggart and Professor X arriving there. Magneto is there to greet them, saying, "Easy to get lost in this part of the world, you know, Bermuda Triangle. It's the whole legend of ships getting lost there." And he says, "But you're beyond the superstitions of men, and you're still lost. You've never lost your way, Charles. So what are you doing here?" And Charles basically says, "Well, I'm here for you, old friend." And Magneto says, "You know what? I cannot tell you how much it would please me to know that you're here to join me. You know, you finally have come around to my way of thinking," is what Magneto is saying here. He says, "But I've learned hard lessons, and I don't really believe there's a place in the world for your dream of peaceful coexistence and mine, where we'll show them that, you know, we are the stronger, and they need to fear us and leave us alone." And I love it at the end. He's like, "Don't believe there's a place in this world for both your dreams and mine, old friend." You know, he puts that emphasis on it. And Professor Xavier says, "You know, what if I told you we were both wrong? Both our dreams are too fleeting, too small for the coming days." And Magneto goes, "Well, I would find it hard to believe you're losing faith. I mean, you always, you know, you're always so strong in your belief and steadfast that, you know, mutants can be heroes and mutants can help humans. And, you know, we can show them that we're good and they'll accept us." He says, "McTaggart, you're a specialist in the behavior of mutants. Do you have any insight into what's wrong with Charles, why he would be doubting his former beliefs?" And Moira says, "Well, I might be the only person on this planet who understands what ails both of you. But I warn you, my truth is profound. It's life-changing. And it all comes down to one thing, Magneto: who truly determines what is good and what is evil?" Right? And she's right. I mean, she's tried Magneto's way. She's tried Charles Xavier's way. She's tried every which way, and it hasn't worked out in all her various lifetimes. So she's 100% correct in saying that she's probably the only person that really understands, because she's gone down all those different threads. She's gone down Magneto's timeline, you know, letting him have his way and you know, supporting him in his dream or his plan. And the same thing with Xavier, and it's never worked out. And we saw that in House of X issue 2. But Magneto, he's not getting it just yet, right? He's still that militant he still has that militant mindset where he says, well, you know who decides? I decide. I decide what's right and wrong. That's the world Magneto wants to live in. And that's the world that Moira MacTaggert supported him in to go down that timeline to let Magneto do, you know, everything he could. And we know that it didn't work out. And that's just Magneto with that sort of persecution complex that he's always carried since the, you know, back in World War II with his parents being in the concentration camps and his people being exterminated by the Nazis. So Charles says, well, you know what, let me show you, right? Open your mind to me, to us, and together we can figure out what we need to do about tomorrow. And of course, Magneto is very suspicious, saying, you sure this isn't some plot to defeat me? You know, they're going to tamper with my mind. And Charles says, please, just this once, trust me. So Magneto takes off his helmet, which, you know, protects him from having his mind read or any telepathic contact with Professor X. So once he removes that, Charles is holding Moira's hand, and they basically allow Magneto to see all the lifetimes that Moira has lived, you know, just like Charles saw on that bench at the carnival or what have you, where Charles first touched Moira's mind and saw all these lifetimes. And Magneto's just as surprised as we all were. What, you're a mutant? All these lives, it was real. And she says, yes, I'm a mutant, and it's as real as it gets. And Magneto says, well, why would you show me all these failures, all the falls? And Professor Xavier says, well, because the truth is profound and life-changing. We always lose, right? We've tried different ways. She's tried different ways, and we always lose. And we believe the only way that mutants are going to survive is if you and I work together. It's time for all of us to come together. And that's the only way that we'll survive. And Magneto says, well, I'm not really interested in just surviving. And Moira says, well, good, because neither are we, right? The one thing we haven't tried is to bring all of mutantum together as one. And that means more than surviving. That means thriving and assuming our rightful place. And that's kind of what we've saw in the first issue of House of X, with the mutants finally saying and drawing a line in the sand saying, enough, we're all coming together. We're going to have our own nation, and we're going to be independent, and we are superior, and we're not going to hide that anymore. We're not going to, you know, try to have Xavier's dream come true by being subservient and by hiding who we are. We're just going to be true to ourselves. And hopefully this is their plan, right? Long-term plan. And with Magneto and Professor X working together, maybe it can work. And Magneto says, well, you know, I'm not going to acquiesce to any sympathy or doubt, right? I'm not going to give an inch. So I'm willing to join you, but if you falter, I will not. And so they shake on it. And that's the start, basically, of a new era, I guess you'd say, of the X-Men. So we turn the page, we get the credits, Jonathan Hickman, writer, RB Silva, artist, RB Silva and Adriano Di Benedetto as inkers, Marte Garcia on colors, and Clayton Cowell on letters. And before we move further into the story, this is the part where I have questions that are not necessarily related to the fact that so much of the Powers of 10 series is, you know, hey, let's jump 10 years in the future, let's jump 100 years in the future, let's jump 1,000 years in the future and talk about these crazy esoteric ideas that Hickman comes up with, because that's a lot of the stuff that he hasn't gotten to yet. And like John Paul said, he may never get to. But what I want to talk about, and I know that you've, you know, you're versed in these eras of the X universe, John Paul. So where exactly does this happen? Like, when, you know what I'm saying? We've read all this. We've read the stories where, and it's in that era you were just talking about, where the X-Men go to Island M and fight Magneto. So
your guess is as good as mine. I'm gonna be honest, it's very nebulous, right? And it's a little bit confusing, but just, I go, hey, it's comics, and just let it slide from there. So
yeah, I just find it so interesting, because if this is where it happened on Island M, then wherever that was, and I think it was like in the one, like around 110, 112, somewhere in there, that they went to Island M and fought him. And so I'm going to assume that this happened a little bit before that. And so then wouldn't the timeline change? Like, so then they would never have fought him on Asteroid M and all that. So yeah, it almost makes it where, why is he telling the story on Krakoa, or if he wants to tell the story on Krakoa, you know, modern times, great, do whatever you want. Isn't there a whole other era of X-Men timeline now between like this event and when they declare, hey, we're going to be our own nation state, that would have unfolded differently?
Like I said, I don't know how to correct that and make it make sense.
Unless Magneto is just a very good act. Let's all pretend that we have a agreement. And when the time is right, then we'll declare ourselves a nation. You know, I mean, you're probably right. It's probably just one of those things where you got to leave it nebulous. You can't think about it too much. But I don't know. I almost feel like, well, maybe in this story, and I sort of get why they did it. Like, maybe Hickman's point is it took that many years between, you know, the Island M meeting here and, you know, present day when they finally are able to declare, hey, we're our own nation. And it's not really the whole, whatever, 30, 40 years of real time, because we know Marvel time is compressed. So maybe it needed, he's trying to basically say, yeah, it took a long time to get there. But my other thought would be, well, maybe don't give it a setting. Like if it wasn't, hey, here it's Island M and they show us the structure or whatever, they could have just made it some kind of nondescript place. Then maybe we don't necessarily have the questions. It could have just been a few weeks. Of course, Professor X was in the wheelchair here and he's not in the wheelchair. And yeah. Anyway, I just, something I noticed, I'm like, wow, how does this exactly, but it goes back to what we were talking about in House of X number 2, where Moira's going back and reliving that life. So at what point, you know, I guess just think of that was all a previous life of hers. And now we're looking at a different timeline in life of hers. So, yeah.
You know, I'm kind of thinking about it. As I was reading it, when it did come out, I was kind of having the same thing going on in my mind as you. I just let it go.
Yeah. Ultimately, I think that's what you have to do. But it is, yeah, it is, again, one of the reasons why I say, don't start here. Go back and read the foundational stuff. Even if it doesn't necessarily all line up, just it's because comics. So
perhaps that's why he did it that way, like as this being the starting point for some X readers.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe like, oh, this is your first, so you could just start with this and not have to worry about all that. I don't know. That's just a guess, but perhaps that was the reasoning behind it.
Yeah, it definitely makes for, like you said, a nebulous sort of timeline. So anyway, let's go ahead and move on. We'll just stick a pin in that and, you know, discuss at a later date if he ever addresses it. But when we turn the page, now we're at X to the One. So it's the X-Men year 10, Krakoa, and Cyclops is joining Professor X and Magneto. They've gotten the information from the like the flash drive or whatever it was, the data storage device that Mystique and her team retrieved from Damage Incorporated. And Cyclops walks in and says, okay, what am I looking at? And Professor X explains to him, well, it plans for a mother mold. It's basically a factory that builds master molds that orbits around the sun. And we saw that in a previous issue. And Cyclops says plans, like it's scheduled to be built or it's something that already exists and we've got the plans for it. And Professor X says, well, as far as we know, it's already been completed and they've just been waiting for the right reason to start it up. And Cyclops says, and let me guess, a mutant whose reach exceeded his grasp, a la the X-Men and the mutants themselves, you know, declaring themselves a sovereign nation. And for the first time we hear about Orcus, see their symbol. I don't think previously when we saw the platform that they were referred to as Orcus, but I could be wrong. I don't remember that. But Magneto says it's a collection of human scientists and they're normally opposed to each other, but they all see mutants as such a big threat. They're overcoming their differences and coming together to stop us. And Xavier says, yeah, from what we've discovered, it's ex-shield agents, AIM, some remnants of SWORD and HAMMER, even a little bit of HYDRA as well. I mean, like I said, they're really putting aside their differences. You know, SHIELD and SWORD would be, you know, more on the heroic side. AIM, HAMMER, and HYDRA would be, you know, more to the villainous side. But yeah, all willing to work together to stop mutants. And so Cyclops says, okay, well, what's the plan? And Professor X says, well, it's pretty simple. We can't let it come online. That's just, you know, bottom line. And there's a couple of really, really great lines in this issue. And this is one of them from Cyclops. He agrees with Professor X. Sure, we can't let it come online. Weather's always a sketchy proposition. You never know when it's going to start raining sentinels. So I kind of love that Hickman gives, he gives Scott some personality, you know, he gives him a little snark instead of being that straight-laced, by the book character that frankly I always found a little bit boring. And so Professor X says, yeah, there is that, but there's also, you know, something else to consider. And Magneto adds, yeah, this with this much scale and these many people working all together, it could indicate a shift in the technology. And Scott's like, wait, next generation Sentinels? Like, I don't get it. They're already built to learn, you know, they're already learning machines. So what are you talking about next level? And Professor X, well, we think this is where Nimrod becomes operational. And Scott's like, oh crap. Right. Cause that's the biggest danger, right? Nimrod, if you're not familiar, is kind of the Uber Sentinel we first saw in Days of Future Past. Real classic story from Uncanny X-Men 141 and 142. That is a massive threat to mutants, you know, able to shape change and do things like that. So Professor X says, hey, they need to be stopped. And Magneto's like, yeah, this is not going to be easy, right? We're talking about a frontal assault on an orbital station that's, you know, tens of millions of miles away, built by a secret organization who's hell-bent on the extermination of mutants. So can we even do it? And here's another one of the great lines from Cyclops. Does it need doing? Professor X answers yes. And he says, then it will be done. You know, that level of confidence is fantastic. So it's a great scene. And really, this is a Cyclops I can root for. Because, you know, you and I, we even did that episode, John Paul, about the Uncanny X-Men Annual 1 that was focused on Cyclops. And even though it wasn't a complete Cyclops spotlight, we talked a lot about how he was sort of boring for a long time, just, you know, sort of straight laced and by the book and, you know, always just that leader that towed the line and followed orders. And even some of his other teammates, you know, they just didn't like him because he was like the hall monitor, you know, always telling them what to do, calling them out when they made something, when they made a mistake or did something wrong. And then it was like, for some reason, some creators decided, well, we need to make him more interesting. And they turned him into a bad guy. They flipped him too far over to the other side. This is adding a little edge to him, what Hickman's doing here, but he's still clearly heroic. So this could be my favorite take on Cyclops that I've seen. You have any thoughts about it?
Well, just reading a recent issue of X-Men, he has sort of the same, what's the assertiveness with the things that he says, but not in like a rude way, but I'm for the cause and let's do this kind of thing. Once you get caught up, you'll see what I'm talking about. But this is going forward. This is what he's going to be like. And it does make him more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, this is a Cyclops that I can be like, yeah, that's cool. I can, rather than the old one, like I said, that I always just found, like, honestly, I just found him boring. That was my thing about Cyclops. It wasn't that I disliked him, but I didn't like him because there was, he was so one-dimensional, you know? So this gives him some edge, you know, gives him a little swagger, and I definitely like it. All right, as we move forward, we jump to X squared. So this is the X-Men 100 timeline. We're on asteroid K, and Wolverine is telling Apocalypse, okay, Cardinal and Rasputin are telling us they succeeded, which is great. They got the information, but, you know, we lost Silo Bell and Percival, And without Percival's blackout abilities, I don't know how getting this information benefits us, because I don't know how we get back into the city, right? Without Percival being able to hide us, basically. And Apocalypse says, you know what? You'll forgive Wolverine, or War. That's the horseman that Wolverine is. He's got a limiting perspective. You guys did a good job. So can I see the product of the spoils? Do you really have it? They say yes. They turn over the data storage device. And Apocalypse says, if you reduce machines down to their essence, they're basically just information, right? Just a repository of knowledge, ones and zeros. And it's such a precarious thing in the hands of the living. You know, too much knowledge, and the weak can be paralyzed or overwhelmed by the amount of choices they have. Not enough knowledge, and you jump in without knowing what you're going to be facing. So you need just enough, you know, just enough information. A little fire from the gods is how he puts it, and that's going to be your great sword that will lead you to victory. So he says, for everybody who sacrificed, it means much that we have this information. So we're going to hear what Apocalypse's plan is for the info they managed to get from the machines. But first, we check in on Nimrod in the Tower of Nimrod the Lesser, the human machine monolith sort of partnership. And Nimrod's kind of vamping here and giving a little speech saying, so these mutants came in and they stole an indexing machine. And this is disturbing. I will not lie. Because normally, you know, I lie. I like to lie. Contrary to what humans may believe, I'm allowed to lie. I'm not programmed to tell the truth. I could lie all day long just for the pleasure of it. But here I am denying myself the joy of half-truths and the bliss of telling fictions and the pure delight of falsehood. And do you know why? I'll tell you. And the two humans that are there are probably just like look at each other going, what? Like, what the hell is this guy? Just like, shut up already. And one of them to that point is kind of like, no, I'd rather you keep talking to yourself. And Nimrod just turns and gives him like the look of death, right? Just like, what did you say? And he realizes it's a mistake right away. He's like, oh, I apologize. It's been a costly day. I'm tired. And Nimrod looks at the other human and says, and my other human friend, are you weary as well? He says, no, of course not, Nimrod. I'm fine. And Nimrod says, I don't believe you. And he just blasts both of them, just disintegrates them. Nothing left but their skeletons. He's like, where was I? Ah, yes, the truth. And then he kind of fills in what they should have answered. Oh, yes, please, Nimrod, give us your truth so that we may know the difference between darkness and light. Well, since you asked so nicely, here it is. I mean, this guy for a machine is like off his rocker. He's just a nut job. That's all there is to it. Too long in his own head, apparently. And he says, okay, so this very existence was encrypted. So they were invisible to our machine eyes, and they came here in secret looking for something, and they must have found it. But I can see you now, mutants, and I know your ways. What were you looking for? So meanwhile, back on Asteroid K, they're accessing the information that was in the data drive that they were able to steal, the indexing machine, as Nimrod calls it. And they're saying, yeah, the problem with machine history is the manner in which it's collected, right? Like, machines, they archive every moment of everything. So if we knew something happened on a particular day, even if we went to their data storage area and we looked for things on that day, we're still searching for billions of actions, right? They're recording everything, each, you know, nanosecond of every second of every minute of, you know, every hour of every day. And so, yeah, it's like our cardinal says, it's like looking for a grain of sand on an endless beach. And so what we need to do before we go to get the information we need is find out exactly where that piece of information is, which is why we got this index. So if we can access this, if Krakoa can decrypt it, we can finally know exactly where to find it. And Krakoa, who is actually a hybrid of Krakoa and Warlock, you know, having Cypher. Ramsey or Cypher, right?
Yeah.
as part of him as well. He says, you know, this body once belonged to a mutant who could communicate with anything. And he's referring to Cypher, Doug Ramsey. He says, I maintain all that he was, even though he's long left this existence. So we will find a way. So between the power of Krakoa and kind of the machine interface of Warlock and the polyglot power of Doug Ramsey, that's how Krakoa is hoping to find the information they need. And Zorn's like, well, you know, what really matters is that even though these mutants are long gone, something still resonates long after the passing, because for most, there's just a march toward oblivion, right? We eat, we sleep, we fight, we die, just as it's always been, as it always will be, until the sun swallows us all. I'm like, man, this guy should be hanging out with Nimrod with these kind of cheerful thoughts. I could only imagine a conversation between Nimrod cracking his terrible jokes and Zorn with his terrible negative fortune cookie speech. One of the mutants even says, oh, you're fantastically depressing, Zorn, the perfect teammate for the end of times. And without missing a beat, he's like, oh, thank you, friend. Like he really does take that as a compliment. And so meanwhile, Krakoa has unlocked the indexing device. And I love Wolverine. His response is, you got to be kidding me. A little mumbly nonsense and the whole world just opens up. Man, I should have been born with brains. So Magneto says, okay, look, here it is. Here's what we're looking for, the node that's got the information. So now we just need to go and get it. And again, Wolverine's reminding them, we still got the problem, right? There's nobody left to go and get it. We only got this far because Percival made us invisible to the machines. We don't have that anymore. So how the heck are we going to get it? We got to fight our way in. We got to hold them off while we get to the thing. And then we got to fight our way out. That's a suicide mission, right? And Zorn, I've never been more excited for anything in my entire life. So Apocalypse steps in and does what Apocalypse does, because like him or not, he's an inspirational guy. He's got charisma. And he says, you know, we're never going to stop the machines, because technology, the future, you know, time marches on. It's all unavoidable. But the question I have is why is the future always aimed at us? Why are we always such a part of it? Is it to test us to see if we're fit to survive? We're going to go. We're going to take what we need, and we are going to return. And this is a promise whose guaranteed whose success is guaranteed, because I'm going to lead you. So I guess with big bad Apocalypse coming along for the fight, you know, he is supremely confident. Some would say arrogant. And so the hope is that they will survive. So this is a much easier chunk of this 100-year era to understand what's going on here. We get a little of the mutants and we understand what their plan is. We get a little bit of Nimrod and understand that he's just a nut job. Nimrod, the nut job, basically. And I don't know, maybe when artificial intelligence reaches a certain stage and thinks it can tell jokes, that it just, I don't know, man, he's just so unstable. Like he's like some kind of psychopath, you know? And maybe it all comes down to the fact that even though, and he himself said this in Powers of 10 in the first issue, talked about, you know, even though I'm programmed to have the ability to emulate emotions, I don't have them, right? So he doesn't have any reservations about blasting these two humans. What does he care? He's not going to feel bad about it. He's just going to do whatever he wants to do whenever he wants to do it. And maybe that's my mistake for kind of putting, you know, human morality and such on a machine, you know, because when you talk about a person who doesn't have any emotional connection or doesn't feel any emotions on a human scale, that's a psychopath, right? Yeah. And that is what he acts like, but you can't really call him a psychopath because he's not human. So, but he is humorous. I will say that.
It's a dark humor, but it's a humor nonetheless.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can kind of say the same thing about Zorn. He's just the straight guy. He just tells it like it is. So that's pretty funny as well. We do get a quick text page here. And again, this is when we start talking about the really kind of out there concepts of Hickman. And this one's about Nimbus. So Nimbus was once called Nibiru, and it was a frozen gas giant. So it was a planet, basically, on this big elliptical solar orbit that went far beyond our solar system. And following the Badoon infestation of the early 31st century, so, you know, far, far in the future, there was a project that was created called the Outreach Project, and it was going to convert Nimbiru into a super intellect in hopes of attracting and establishing a alliance with a Type 3 interstellar civilization, which we'll talk about what a Type 3 interstellar civilization is at the end. So basically, they wanted to mirror the Kree intelligence model. You know, and if you're familiar with the Kree and the Supreme Intelligence, they had 100 of their most intelligent scientists, basically, sort of, and scholars and artists, and, you know, just 100 of their smartest citizens, basically, that all kind of gave up their lives and integrated all their minds together into a hive mind. And so they're trying to do the same kind of thing here. They get 100 of the greatest post-human scientists, scholars, and artists of their generation, and they all submitted to having their minds copied and then integrated into a single thinking machine called Nimbus. And they put it in a Nimrod shell, and they sent it from Earth to Nibiru, and it took about 4 years to get there. Now, it could have got there sooner, we're told, but it stopped on the way to consume multiple Saturn moons and multiple Jupiter moons to increase its density and intellect, which would then help increase the conversion rate once it arrived at Nibiru. So once it got to Nibiru, it crashed into it, and it tore through the upper atmosphere and all embedded itself in the mantle of the ice giant, and used the force of the impact to inject its self-replicating machines into the very core of the planet. And so once there, it started consuming and converting the iron nickel of the core into its memory farms, you know, basically became sort of like this living computer, and started turning all the raw materials of Nimbiru into like a giant computer, basically. So as its number of memory farms, the amount of memory it has, and its logic crystals, which is the equivalent of like your computer processor, and the memory farms would be the equivalent of the RAM in your computer. So as these things grew, as the iron and nickel was converted, the intelligence level of this kind of living planet, as it's coming to be established, it grows, right? Until eventually the goals of the Outreach Project were achieved, and Nimbus reached world mind status 10 years after impact. So it took 10 years from Nimbus arriving on Nibiru to create enough memory farms and enough logic crystals, having converted the iron and nickel to basically make this former planet into a giant brain, if you will. So again, big, crazy concepts that that Hickman is giving us here. So we turn the page, now we're at X cubed. So this is the X-Men year 1000. And we see the librarian talking to Nimrod. And this is the, you know, little floating Skeets kind of version of Nimrod, saying Nimrod did it work. And Nimrod responds, well, normally civilizations of our maturity only attract universal predators. And this is because the perceived value of our type of system is found in its celestial resources, not the living culture, right? So what is there in our solar system that could attract what they're looking to attract, basically? And so Nimrod says, yeah, our system is a place to be mined and not preserved. If anybody were to come here, one of these higher interstellar civilizations, and when I say higher, like higher up the intelligence chain or the advancement chain, far more advanced, they would be coming to the solar system that contains Earth to mine it of its resources, of its raw materials, not to come and incorporate any of the culture or intelligence or anything, because this civilization that exists in the Earth solar system is just not advanced enough. The culture is not important enough because those other civilizations are far too advanced. So he says, after hundreds of years of, you know, skirmishes and wars, you know, we convert Nimbus into a world mind to show the world what we're capable of. And it seems that we did get the attention of somebody. So librarian, did it work? You're asking me, did it work? Well, I think we're about to find out. And we see this sort of cloud of dark goo traveling and landing on the platform next to the librarian and forming these humanoid type forms. And they say, we, the Falniks, ate your world mind. So they, this world that I was just describing, this world mind that was just created by crashing Nimbus into Nibiru is gone. This Falniks interstellar civilization has eaten it. And they say they fought for sovereignty and they lost, but we, the Falniks, saw the whispering gods behind it. We, the Falniks, heard your message, now hear ours. What do you seek? So to answer the librarian's question, yes, it worked 100%. The fact that the civilization that exists in this X cubed, you know, far advanced future, by showing that they had the ability to create a world mind, they were able to get the attention of a vastly superior interstellar civilization. That interstellar civilization consumed the world mind, and in that consumption learned about the civilization that currently is existing on Earth and said, hey, and that would be the whispering gods, as the Falniks refers to it. Hey, let's go see what these guys on Earth are all about. And so they've arrived and they're asking, what do you seek? Why, you know, why did you want our attention? And their response is ascension. They want to ascend to, with the help of the Falniks, to a higher level on the interstellar civilization scale or ladder, if you will. So we get a couple more pages of text here. And this stuff, again, gets into really, really esoteric ideas from Hickman. And before we cover them, I want to talk about some of the conversations I had this week on social media about these text pages. So I saw somebody who said, in effect, yeah, whenever I come to the Hickman text pages in any of the X-Men books, I just say, yeah, that's cool, not for me, and I just skip them and move right on. And while I that's totally valid and I get it, you're buying comics to read stories and sequential art and not, you know, if you want a big block of text or a whole page of text, you'll read a book, right? Or a magazine or something like that. So while I understand that, the completest part of me that wants to be sure I understand the whole story could never skip the text pages. And as John Paul and I have both talked about in the past, they add so much to the story because Hickman's ideas are so big. You just can't tell it just in the pages without it taking, you know, 10, 12 issues or planting the seeds over the course of a 14-year run like Chris Claremont, you know, and ain't nobody got time for that. So this is a shortcut, and I don't begrudge Hickman for doing it, but I do understand why people might not like it. What are your thoughts on it, John Paul?
You know, before I had said that I don't skip the text pages, this is the one that I did skip the initial first time. I did, like, totally was like, this is too much for me. I was like, I'll get back to it later. And I did. I read it over earlier today. It's a lot. It's definitely high concept. And I'm like, whoa. Yeah, I could see why somebody would skip this.
Yeah. And again, some of these ideas, when we start talking about the biggest ideas that Hickman has and the ones that are flung out so far in the future that he hasn't come back and touched on, you may not need to read it. He may never get to it.
Right.
So there's that to consider as well. But I'm just going to go over it real briefly. And if you want to dive, you know, deeper into it, you can. And there's plenty of information about this stuff on the internet as well. So the first page is types of societies when you're talking about planetary societies. And he has them divided up into SI1, SI10, SI 100 to 10,000. So the SI stands for society, species intelligence. So when you talk about SI1, that's a machine, right? So a single machine mind, it's a direct copy of a human mind, a sentient mind, and it represents the thinking power of one single individual sentient mind of a species. So if we had the technology to copy my brain or your brain or John Paul's brain and you know, create an artificial intelligence out of it that could think on its own, that would be SI1. Next, we have SI10, which is a hive. So now you're talking about collecting basically 10 of the SI1s and unifying them together up to 10 machines. And so now they've got that much more thinking power, right? However, if you go any higher than 10 machines and you've got them all trying to work together as a collective, the intelligence starts to fall apart. It starts to fracture because you're repressing so much individuality of each of the copied individual brains, basically, that they kind of fight amongst themselves. And that sort of fracturing overwhelms the ability of the hive. And it does say, note, unlike intelligences, hives are mature individual intellects working together that were not created to naturally reach beyond their machine state. So they're not created to work together, basically. When you start talking about species intelligence level 100 to 10,000, now you're talking about thinking machines that were created to be part of at least a hive of 100, if not more. So they're all created in a way that they're all supposed to work together toward a collective goal. So the Kree Supreme Intelligence is an example of this. They were direct copies of Kree philosophers and thinkers. They were merged into a single intellect, and they based that intelligence on pre-existing beings in order to level up that society. But that's a lot less common when you get further up the galactic scale. Next, we have SI-10,000, which they call a technarch. So this is an artificial intelligence collective that is manufactured by a society like the Fanlix. And it's created to classify, order, and assimilate other existing societies. So think of it as kind of like a harvester, right? So the purpose is to, you know, take the intelligence of another society and repurpose it so that it can be used for something else. So the technarch, it just exists as a single node, and it can take the shape of a world, but it can be other things. And each technarch believes it's the only technarch in existence, and technarchs are invisible to other technarchs. And I'm not sure why that's important, but the fact that he puts it in there makes me think it must be important for what he has planned further down the line. When you start talking about 100,000 SI, you're talking about a world mind. So this is a celestial object, commonly a planet, that has been wholly converted into a singular intellect. So that's what we were talking about before, when a Nimbus was fired into Nibiru and eventually terraformed the whole planet by consuming the iron and nickel, turned it all into memory and logic crystals. So these intellects possess a godlike intelligence, and they act on a timeline of millennia. So they think, far, 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 far into the future. They're many, many moves ahead. And on the Kardashev scale, a world mind represents a type 2 civilization. And then the last species intelligence level we're told about is 1 million, which is a Phalanx, which is like those beings that showed up at the end of the issue that I talked about. And a Phalanx is an interstellar society that operates on a galactic scale, and it represents an intellect that has the total control of a host galaxy. So think of it like a world mind that has expanded to basically control a whole galaxy. So at this level of society, the intellect exists only to continue to exist and expand its own intelligence by consuming lesser societies and to control the energy that it needs to continue to expand. So at some level, when you reach this Phalanx level, your only reason for existing is to continue to exist and continue to grow. So if a Phalanx encounters a society that it feels is worth consuming, it adds its intelligence, right? by using that technarch that I mentioned earlier. Send the technarch in, absorb the smaller society, turn it into intelligence and assimilate its knowledge, and then it's transferred to the Foundlings. If it's not worth adding, then you just harvest the solar system. Like I was saying earlier, you would just harvest the whole solar system and all the planets in the Earth solar system just to be raw materials to allow the Foundlings to continue to grow. So those are basically the levels of species intelligence. And again, I know that we're getting out there with what Hikmet is doing here, and hopefully I'm explaining it to you in simplest terms. I'm kind of trying to simplify it for you. On that Kardashev scale, a Foundlings represents a type 3 civilization. So there is a couple of graphical pages here that kind of explain and show what I'm talking about. And then on the last page, we have a quote from Professor X saying, "You must see by now there is no you and I, there's only us. We are together or we are nothing." So that's kind of bringing home what I was, or what Professor X was saying in the beginning when he and Moira were trying to get Magneto on their side, going, "We've tried everything else." You know, Moira lived timelines going along with Charles and trying to fulfill his dream. She lived a timeline, you know, supporting Magneto and following Magneto's every wish and trying to, you know, follow his plan for mutants to take over, basically. And that didn't work either. And having seen all that, Professor X is, you know, telling Magneto, "Hey, there is no you or I. It's only us. This is the only way that we survive. Otherwise, we're nothing. Otherwise, you know, mutants are destroyed." So that's how we end the issue. It not a lot in this issue in terms of events that happen, but a lot in terms of those, that first chunk where Moira and Professor X go to Magneto so early on. You know, we talked about what era it happened in. That is so important. And yeah, maybe we can't reconcile it with what we know of X-Men history, but going to Magneto that early, that really does change everything. And then, you know, seeing this new side of Cyclops, which I loved, obviously is cool. And then we get the future stuff where, you know, the 100-year stuff is not too hard to swallow. It's pretty straightforward. You could almost think this is that far in the future. It's still a pretty straightforward story. But man, when you get into that the timeline that's 1,000 years in the future, that's where that's where Hikmet is like, pop some LSD or, you know, come up with these ideas of different types of societies and different levels of intelligence. Yeah, you're out there now, Hikmet. You are out there for sure. So, but I kind of enjoyed that stuff, you know, and that's why I definitely read it, because I know I get something out of it. But you know, to John Paul's point about him not checking it out the first time, you have to be in the right mindset to read it. You know, like if you just came off like a 10-hour, you know, shift and you got home and, you know, ate a little dinner and had a couple beers and then you're going to plop down and read this, I don't blame you for going, you know, your eyes, you start to read it and your eyes just glaze over.
Yeah.
So it can be kind of tough. So, but overall, I thought it was a pretty enjoyable issue. Things are definitely starting to take place. It's amazing to me when I think about the fact that this is only Powers of 10 issue 2, and I already feel like I'm deep within these timelines that Hikmet has created. So that is a credit to him that we're getting, you know, little scenes from each different timeline, but it's enough to make us feel like we're invested and we have a good sort of grasp on kind of the overall tone of the story that he wants to tell in each particular timeline. What do you think, John Paul?
Well, I was just going over these types of societies, both planetary and galactic, and trying to give like an example for each specific one based on like the Marvel universe. And I can kind of like make similarities for like the Hive being the Clintar with the different symbiotes, and the intelligence being the Kree Supreme Intelligence, World Mind being like Ego, right?
Yeah.
But the Technarch and the phalanx, those are the ones still trying to put like a on it.
Yeah, yeah. When you start talking about those types of societies, because we haven't seen them before,
right?
I mean, these are new things that that Hickman has come up with. So, but still, I think interesting. And but you almost think, well, just go write that story. And if somebody wants to dive that deep, which Hickman has, you know, if you read some of his other stuff like Decorum over at Image, that gets out there. His East of West series over at Image kind of is sort of out there as well. So don't blame anybody for not reading the text, but I think it does add to the story. It really does.
Yeah.
Anything to say about the art by R.B. Silva?
It's never distracting. Like there's none of that, like the one panel with Professor X in the previous issue or the beady eyes.
Yeah.
None of that. It's good. I'd have no problem with it. Other than that, I don't really feel like it's standout. If that makes sense.
No, and I kind of agree with you. There was only like one panel where I found myself thinking, oh man, that's really great. And it's the scene where Magneto sort of gets the big info dump of all of Moira's different lives.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Other than that, I think the art is fine, like John Paul said, but there's nothing that, yeah, really makes it stand out. But I think the reason for that in this issue is because he didn't get to draw any like action or fight scenes.
That's true.
It's a lot of just talking heads. So he did, you know, it's still good art, and you know, he plays with the shapes of panels a lot, which helps it from being, you know, boring. I never thought, oh man, this issue is just a slog.
No.
So I think he's done a good job with the script that he had to work with for this, that you don't ever realize until you go back and look at it. Oh, there wasn't even any action or fight. And I didn't notice that, you know, because there are other comics I've read where I'm like, man, this is just boring. It's just people talking. So he keeps the art interesting enough. But yeah, I just feel like he didn't really have that much to work with. That's probably why I did notice that purplish panel, which is great. I love that they use the purple because that's kind of Magneto's color at this time. But it's kind of, even though it's just a collage of different timelines and Magneto events, it's the closest thing we get to an action panel in the whole series. Well, that, or the whole issue rather, that and when Nimrod blasts the two humans that probably right. deserved better. But I will also say that the color by Marte Garcia is really great in the issue as well. He sort of has a slightly different color palette for each time period, which kind of helps to separate them out from each other. So I want to give him a shout out as well. So anyway, any last thoughts on this issue, John Paul?
You know, I was just looking through the pages and I found one panel that was standout. The one with the close-up of Cyclops. I think that it has more to do with the coloring than the art, not to disparage the art, but that's a cool one. It was just his visor and his nose.
Oh, says, right. Yeah. When he says, yeah, this then it will be done. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did notice that specifically the red of his visor, like you're saying, how it's glowing, it gives it a little menace, but yeah, that's more Marte Garcia, but yeah. Anyway, that's going to do it, everybody, for this this particular episode of X Tuesday. We hope you all enjoyed it. Don't feel obligated to read the text pages, but there is info there, which is basically what we all sort of the agreement that we all came to on when we had our Twitter conversation about it. Read the way you want to read, you know, live and let live. There is worth to it, I think, but I think you can enjoy the story at a more surface level without reading them. So that's if you only take away one thing from this this episode, it can be that. So anyway, be sure you check out all of our picks for the best comics of 2020. We released those two episodes. We split it up into two episodes this year just to make it a little easier for you to digest. So those came out last Saturday and Sunday. We had a great conversation. Unfortunately, John Paul wasn't able to make it. Next year, we'll do it sooner and earlier, and we'll be, and I say this every year, we're going to plan it out better, but yeah, next year we'll be a little earlier, because I know put it out early February, it's like, wait, you guys are still talking about 2020. But anyway, they were a lot of fun. We talked about a lot of great comics. So if you're curious, go and check them out. So as always, want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.